At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Get out now. No doubt now.
Friday morning, June 30th, 2023. It is the Beating the Book podcast. Gil Alexander. It is Wimbledon. Tennis's third major of the year, the grass major, if you will. The shortest of all seasons in terms of surfaces in tennis. Grass court season is like 5 weeks total. So this podcast, and when we're sort of wedging it in, reflects the nature of that grass court season. Just as it's hard for some players to squeeze in matches before Wimbledon, it was hard to squeeze in this podcast. But Drew Densick, as always, kind enough to join us to make it happen. You can follow him on Twitter at @whale_capper. He's the host of not one, but two podcasts, the Deep Dive podcast, which he does with Andy Molitor, and of course, NBC Sports Bet the Edge. And one of, I'm embarrassing him maybe a little. I don't know if he's going to agree with this. One of the great global tennis minds that there is. How about that, Drew? How you doing, man?
I'll take it. Right. I think there are many, 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 many greater global tennis minds. But if you want to give me a qualification of being able to weave what I'm seeing on tennis into a handicap better than, you know, your average, you know, tennis fan or prognosticator, that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll go with that.
Yeah.
So here's the deal, everybody. So we're recording this at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 noon Eastern on Friday. Mm-hmm. The main draw begins in less than 48 hours. They just put out the draw this morning in terms of overnight stateside. So while we were sleeping, the men's and the women's draw came out as other random grass court tournaments in England and Germany specifically wind down, and some people are quitting left and right. Iga, for instance, said, I'm not feeling well. She decided after getting to the semis, her first semi of a grass court tournament, she's like, deuces. Sounds to me like she's just getting ready for Wimbledon. I don't know, but that's what it sounds like. So the concern this morning was, because I just did a numbers game that started 2 hours before this. When I started a numbers game, I just wanted to talk about my thoughts on the draw, and hopefully there would be some numbers associated with the quarters. At that time, 2 hours ago, they were just trickling in while I was talking about it. So I was just sort of doing it theoretically, and then some came in. We have women's numbers as we do this. I don't believe we have men's numbers. Are you seeing that?
I'm looking everywhere. There's men's quarters at a couple of spots.
Oh, there is. Okay, good.
Yeah, there's a pretty good amount of numbers. I mean, my numbers now that we've got the draw and I've kind of run some sims and I have, you know, actual win probabilities for quarters here are hot off the press. I haven't even really digested these, trying to kind of, you know, kind of give them a little bit of added scrutiny. So, yeah. Okay. You know, there's some, we may say some things on this podcast that ultimately I either don't act on or revise as I continue to, you know, kind of go through this process. Cause yeah, as you're mentioning, like you're getting a very raw response reaction to, you know, what is a very interesting draw. On a women's tournament fascinating.
Yeah. Do you want to start with the women, or should we crescendo to the women? Your call.
I guess maybe let's go a step back and do a little bit of why is grass unique?
Okay.
Why is this a difficult handicap? We know we had, you know, the last time we, you know, talked to deep tennis, it was you know, the finale of Clay Season. Clay Season is, you know, two and a half months long. It even kind of is preceded by Indian Wells in Miami. Indian Wells, very, you know, very slow, hard court. So you have a kind of a good sample of, you know, player form and kind of, you know, court speed specific form for Clay, you know, as you head into Roland Garros. And then everything gets flipped on its head. And the entire game is different when you go from clay to grass, from Roland Garros to, you know, the grass run up. And the grass run up is extremely compressed. There are players who, you know, bagged it during clay because they're not especially good on that surface, who have come out of nowhere and shown amazing form so far on grass. There are players who, you know, you thought were kind of putting something together this season, who have stepped on a grass court and just wildly underwhelmed. And, you know, I think I tend to try to treat what we see in the run up on grass with extreme caution, just because there are lots and lots of examples of losing quarter bets in my portfolio where we were like, my God, did you see how good that guy looked in Hala? And then he shows up and loses in round one. And there's that general sense of success on grass in the lead up leading to success at Wimbledon, I don't think is surprising because of the compressed schedule. Right. A lot of the best players don't take it seriously. They literally are like, this is too short. This, yeah, as you mentioned, Iga's played a couple of warmups. You know, anyone that bet on her to win in Bad Homburg for a championship is probably like, what the hell? Like, she's clearly the best in that field. Not even close. Whatever the outright markets were there, she was the right bet. But, you know, her deuces. Motivations are a little, yeah, her motivations are a little different than everybody else's. So, you know, it's the players who have already had success this season, who have already won titles, who have already gotten points, who have already won money, I don't think you can really look at their results and make any, draw any conclusions. And then the flip side is true. If you have won a title on grass so far in the run up, like, you know, you may be thinking, man, mission accomplished. You know, I'll go to Wimbledon. I'll pick up a check. I'll enjoy the pomp and circumstance. I'll have some strawberries and cream. And then, you know, it's hard court season, you know, so it's a little tough to read too much into what you've seen the last 3 weeks. And I would just say exercise some caution. In terms of the game on grass, it's different because the rallies are substantially shorter. Sets are shorter. You know, this just in general, you know, games are shorter, sets are shorter, hold percentage is substantially higher on grass than it is on clay because the speed of the surface and because of, you know, what it affords certain players who have especially strong, fast serve or especially good placement with their serve. You know, they become quote unquote grass specialists just because they're extremely tough to break. Because of that, tie breaks, you know, games in a given set go up relative to clay. You see a lot higher percentage of tie breaks, particularly in sets one on grass relative to any other surface. And then as we, you know, specifically look at Wimbledon itself, you know, the grass is a living organism and yes, it changes from day one to day 12 of this tournament as it gets played on and as it gets beaten up. And, you know, the weather that can, you know, the weather and the moisture in the air and the heat, all of that definitely tends to, you know, change the overall surface speed from, you know, from the beginning to the end of the tournament. And that's something you got to weave in as well. It's different on center court than it is on some of the show courts. You know, so there is a million moving parts that make this especially difficult and fun handicap. And I think, you know, just kind of come into this with a little bit of a, be ready to be surprised by some stuff that happens in week one.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me get back to that fun comment you just made, because in the end you said, oh, it's fun. You know, part and parcel with everything you just said, because somebody asked me on Twitter this morning during the show, they were like, hey, is this your best slam? I was like, oh, hey, I didn't say this, but I felt like, oh, hell no, right? It's not, for all the reasons you state. Also, you know, just the data itself, right? There's less, sure, of it. And that makes sense because it's only like a 5 week grass court season. So really, you know, if we're doing hard courts, I won't just speak for myself. Typically you're looking at year, you're looking at 6 months. Drew is also a guy who likes to look at recency more than perhaps, yeah, others. And I think hard court, the numbers are so, so predictive. And obviously there's different gradations of hard court too, but generally speaking, hard court numbers are really predictive in a way that grass isn't. And so it causes this thing where it's like, if you have somebody who's been at this for a long time, you can trust those grass numbers. But you also, if you have someone who doesn't have any at all, it's not like you can throw them out in the same way that you could, because you just don't, you don't really know in this very truncated thing, because you don't have as much robust data for others. So I guess in the end, the question is, you use the word fun. Is it in the end for you, or do you feel like this is more art than science, if you will?
Yeah, no, it's definitely is more art. Absolutely. I would, and I think your point is fair. Like, what, you have a huge, huge imbalance in sample size between players like Petra Kvitova, who have played a million grass matches, and players like Iga, who have not.
Yeah.
And like, coming up with a fair price for those two, if that's your final, that's art.
100%.
It is.
Yes.
And I would even say that, like, because it's such a serve oriented surface, the best bets I tend to make at Wimbledon come around the halfway point, where you get a sense of how good a player's serve is in terms of just rhythm. Like, serve, I, in my mind at least, is a very hot hand kind of deal, right? If you're serving with confidence, you know, you continue to serve well. If you're playing tie breaks with confidence, you continue to play tie breaks well. Like, these are weird little mental wrinkles that are very much part of the art of handicapping on grass. And, you know, I think, like, was, you remember the Wimbledon that Garbine Muguruza
won? Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So that one stands out in my mind, because coming into that, she was like, what, you would have thought 50th choice. Like, you know, like, you hadn't seen anything to tell you that that was going to happen, but you watched enough of kind of week one from her and saw what, you know, what was happening with her game that week and the confidence she was playing in. And you were like, oh my God, who's beating her? You know, like, that, that type of stuff happens. You know, Rybakina last year, you know, I mean, I don't think there were probably people who thought before the tournament, like, I'm just going to continue to bet her until she wins one, because she ultimately will. I have confidence in her game, blah, blah, blah. I'm sure people did that. But you, I certainly didn't see any signal before, you know, she showed up, and, you know, before you saw what she was playing with confidence wise. And particularly, she ousted, did she oust Iga last year, or was,
no, Cornet did, I believe.
Cornet did. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, she had a couple wins either way. Beating Simona Halep in the semifinals is probably the one that stands out then, where, you know, Halep was, you know, I think she was pretty heavy favorite over Rybakina in that moment. And that was a one way match. And, you know, she rode that momentum to a title. You don't need to really reflect anymore other than that on last year's final. But
the greatest, you know, thing about that final that I will always remember is her lack of her lack of a reaction when she won first slam. Yeah. She was just nonplussed. She was like,
business as usual.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think, you know, I agree. It's art more than science. It's, you know, you are stuck with a lot of sample size issues with the data. So that takes, you know, that levels the playing field a little bit. I don't think there's any kind of NBOS grass tennis originator out there who's coming up with numbers and prices and shaping the market to the way that, like, even just your average Joe who's been, you know, coming up with fares based on some mental model. I don't think those type of players are out of the game. Whereas other services, other tournaments, they definitely are.
No, totally agree. This is in, now, having said all that, the draw came out and there are definitely some lines you can draw to bets. And let's start on the women's side, because this is more meaty than the men's side, which obviously has Novak Djokovic and Carlos Alcaraz at the top. But on the ladies side, and I don't know what your reaction was, but my reaction to the draw was, holy shit, did they make Q3 and Q4 much more densely populated with players than Q1 and Q2, players that can, you know, have a shot at going deep in this tournament. So Q1 is the Swiatek quarter, if you will. Kasatkina, Goff, Bencic there. Q2, I mean, I already recommended on the show this morning, I have a Kudermetova bet there. You got Pegula, you got Vekic. I know you like Donna Vekic. Caroline Garcia is there. To a lesser extent, Leila Fernandez and Ludmila Samsonova. But then Q3 and Q4, and I'll just leave this for you to comment afterwards. Q3's got Jabeur, Pliskova, Kvitova, Haddad Maia, Ostapenko, and Rybakina. And Q4's got Sakari, Keys, Andreeva, Krejcikova, Alexandrova, and Sabalenka. Good God.
Yeah, I share your sentiment. And when you see something like this, it's, you know, I would qualify it as an imbalanced draw.
Yep.
Sure. Even though Iga's on the top is weak. The bottom is strong. And you, I think you correctly laid it out. Like my percentages for Iga to win Q1 and Kudermetova to win Q2 relative to my percentages for those same players winning the title are outsized. Right.
Right.
And so attacking them with Q1, Q2 type of bets, as opposed to taking them outright, makes sense to me. But then again, taking them outright and expecting that there's going to be chaos on the other side of the draw, and you don't know for sure that the worst case, you don't know that the worst case player is going to come through. And I don't even know that we can sit here and tell you sincerely who the worst case player would be for an Iga, right?
That's exactly right. We don't know.
I could be. It could be Rybakina.
I would say full strength Rybakina.
Probably. Full strength Rybakina. Yes. Yeah. Could be Kvitova just because of her, experience surface.
Actually, I would say it's a toss up between those two. Yes.
Yeah. Yep. I wouldn't entirely rule out Sabalenka if she's playing with confidence and her service firing. That's not crazy.
I'll be honest with you, Drew. I have to keep reminding myself that she's a contender. I don't know what that is about me, but I have Kvitova and Rybakina. For me, when I'm just looking at historical numbers, right? Jabeur is actually great, but she's not in top form. Kvitova's next, but Krejcikova, Sakkari, Kudermetova, Ostapenko, I'm just going down the list. You've got Ostapenko and Rybakina and Kvitova all in that. Jabeur all in that. You got a Servbot and Pliskova. You got Haddad Maya in there. So, I think the answer is probably to your question is probably a full strength Rybakina and Kvitova. But yeah, if Ostapenko got there and she was just killing, I'd be terrified of her too.
Sure. Yeah. In a lot of the lead up before we saw the draw, I would have told you I have a list of 12 women who I have greater than 2% chance to win.
Let's hear that.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of players. Yeah.
10 of them are on the bottom. 2 of them are on the top.
And the 2 on the top are Swiatek and Kudermetova.
Correct.
Yep. Totally agree.
That's a huge imbalance.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you do with that? I think basically if you really had eyes for, if you already have a bet in pocket on, on Kvitova, this was a big old give me a break kind of a draw, because a ton of the equity you've already captured with her form you've seen so far this year has kind of been tilted back into the Iga bucket, which is a bummer. But that's fine. The idea of being able to get a decent price on Kvitova against some of these women she's going to have to go through, you're going to get a good, it'll be a good, maybe perceived as an interesting matchup against Pliskova in round 3, a good matchup against Jabeur in round 4. If Jabeur gets there, man, I don't know what's going on with her. And then presumably Rybakina, in the quarterfinal, that's a 1-2-3 right there. That's going to get you some pretty good rollover type of pricing. And then Sabalenka in the semifinals and Iga in the finals, I think a rollover on Kvitova, worst case scenario in terms of who she would face, would probably get you in the 12 to 15 to 1 range. And I think her prices are a little shorter than that.
Shorter consensus. You might be able to find a 12 to 1 out there, but yes,
yeah,
typically shorter.
So you're going to have to make some decisions, and you actually can be a little bit patient and watch a couple of rounds, see how things are materializing on the bottom, and then kind of ride a specific player round by round, as opposed to outright on the bottom. There's also always the possibility you wake up one morning and Rybakina is out because of illness, right? There's a chance that Jabeur gets upset in round 1 or something. And then all of a sudden that section of the draw for Kvitova is a lot softer. Right. I think there's a little bit of, you have to exercise caution if you're going to look at things this way. But I think that's the right way to look at it math wise, just because some of the players we haven't even mentioned that are very good are on the bottom. Mm-hmm. Alexandrova is in my 12 for sure. She's got an interesting spot in the draw. I really don't know what to make in terms of Krejcikova right now, but she's shown you enough on grass, I think, in the run-up that and enough in this year so far in terms of quality of play that Krejcikova has to be, you know, in the mix. Andreeva, I really don't know what to make of because she is a total unknown on grass.
No grass data whatsoever on any tour.
Yeah, and her outright prices are just wildly unbettable. There's it's nonsense that she's in like the 50-1 range.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
What are you gonna do?
No, when I was going through Q4, I don't know if you caught it. I mentioned Alexandrova, Krejcikova, okay. Andreeva. Yeah. I also mentioned Sakkari and Keys. Sakkari's grass numbers are really good, and we just don't think about her. Could this finally be the tournament for her?
She looks like an out in round three to Keys to me.
Yeah, she does.
And, you know, Sakkari falls in a specific bucket of players that I just never even really consider because they consistently underperform at the slam level relative to their numbers. Doesn't matter. Like, kind of seems like it doesn't matter. There's some guys who fall into that bucket pretty clearly too that we'll talk about, I'm sure. But you know, I kind of will pay to see Sakkari do it at the slam level at this point. The inexcusable that she didn't win that French Open that Krejcikova won, considering how that broke for her. The other name you didn't mention in the Q4 though is your French Open finalist, Carolina Mukova.
Yes, I did not mention her. You're correct.
Mukova.
Yeah.
She could pop again. Entirely possible. You know, she has on record as clay is not her favorite surface, and yet there she was in the last two. Actually, there she was with a chance to serve it out.
it's but, funny, though, you say that because immediately, like we just talked about how, you know, with this data, it's tough. I look at her because my instinct is to look at the data, right? And her grass data is not that spectacular. But then again, this isn't hard courts, right? This is like, well, do I trust that? You know, do I trust her recent form or that? And the answer is probably the recent form. If I came to you from the future in Q4 and I said, okay, Sabalenka didn't win it. Alexandra, Krejcikova, Andreeva, Keys, Sakkari, Mukova. Who won it?
Oh, man. Just seeing what we've seen so far. I mean, again, like I'm talking myself into this to a degree. Even though I caution not to overreact to what you've seen this year. But Alexandrova's game on grass has been dynamite.
Yes.
And she's got the skill set to pop here. I have a little 80-1 in pocket for her, so maybe I'm like, you know, trying to will it to happen.
Well, no, I mean, just to give people a sort of a sense. So Alexandrova was supposed to play Kudermetova. I want to say it was last week, and the match never happened, and one of them decided not to play it. But I remember I remember having the over in it, and also it was really tightly lined. I think Alexandrova had just beaten Kudermetova. I actually was on Kudermetova in that. It could have gone either way. Yeah. I think money came in on Kudermetova as well. But essentially, when we're sitting here praising Kudermetova, she just got the benefit of a better draw. But Alexandrova was right up there with her.
Yeah, they played in, was it Ertagenbosch, I think, the final?
Wow. I would not remember. Yeah.
It was Alexandrova Kudermetova. It was a draw.
Yeah.
Alexandrova ultimately won, but it was a draw.
Right.
I would say that just if, you know, again, like, what have we seen? She's going to be in the mix. Absolutely. She's going to be in the third round against Mukova almost certainly. What a murderer's run for her though. Alexandrova is going to have to go through Mukova in round three.
It's a gauntlet.
Sabalenka in round four. And then somebody awesome in the quarterfinals, maybe Keys is playing amazingly well. And she's the opposite of a Sakkari where Keys tends to overperform at the slam level relative to the numbers you get from her on tour. Although at the same time, like she's deep this week, right? She's probably going to win Eastbourne.
Yeah, she is still alive. She beat Coco this morning. So she's still alive. That's right.
Convincingly beat Coco.
Yep.
Yeah. She's got Kasatkina in the final tomorrow.
But this is Keys. I mean, like she's, again, Keys was in a Grand Slam final. Remember, she lost to Sloane Stephens in 2018, I want to say, or US Open in 2018. Don't hold me to that year.
That sounds right.
Or 2017, something like that. But, you know, you could see it wouldn't shock me if it was like one of these things where like later in her career, there's a bubble up, right? because
yeah, of course,
yeah. Yeah. So she's great on these services. So, I mean, here's what I've bet so far, just to brass tacks it for folks. What I've bet on the, for those who missed it on the numbers game, I have an EGA to win it outright from many months ago at 4-1. She was close to 4-1 all week. Last couple of days, she's gotten shorter. This draw will make it even shorter. But EGA to win it all just because it's my reflex in life. Like I breathed better. But I also bet a Swiatek Djokovic parlay at Bookmaker, got plus 550 on that. I also, though, have a Kvitova Djokovic parlay, which is 13-1. That's what I already have in pocket. I am going to add a Kvitova outright. I see a 12-1 out there. I'm going to grab it if it's still available after this show. And quarters, hopefully they're available. I can't wait to live in a state where it actually has legalized sports. but hopefully there will be quarters available because Kudermetova, which I recommended this morning, was at 5-1. I don't know if it's, I think it got shorter at 4-1 after I talked about it. Kudermetova Q2 and Kvitova Q3 ultimately at plus 333 was the number this morning. Even though it is a stacked quarter, I still might bet that. But that's what I have. You, what have you bet so far?
So I'm holding, I'm in the same situation as you where I'm waiting for quarter prices. Where I can bet them, yeah. But I do see, I mean, EGA at evens for Q1
kind of like that too, man.
Yeah. That's a bet by my numbers.
Yeah.
I think she should be about minus 145. At least that's, you know, this is again, raw projections. I think she should be about minus 145. Kudermetova, if you got her at 5-1, it was a great bet. 4-1. I still see value. My fair there is plus 375. Mm-hmm. And then on the bottom, let's see. Oh, I'm surprised Vekic is actually the favorite in Q2, huh? Huh. Interesting.
I saw that. She is the short shot in Q2, which I know you love her. I don't quite understand that.
Well, love is a strong word. There's enough success and signal to not completely dismiss her. Certainly, I think you have to stack her above the likes of the Pagulas and the Garcias of the world.
I would agree with that.
But yeah, I think Kudermetova and Iga are the two quarter plays on the top. And then the bottom, if you want to take a swing against Rybakina, because either she's just not there physically or she may withdraw, I don't think that's crazy.
By the way, let me just clarify what Drew is saying, because some people might not know.
Sure.
Elena Rybakina, who is considered one of the big three along with Swiatek and Sabalenka, regardless of surface here, she pulled out of the French Open, I want to say after round three, with a virus just out of the blue. And that really, Iga was already the favorite, but Rybakina's withdrawal really made her the favorite. That's Iga's surface to lose to begin with. But Rybakina has kind of been her kryptonite. Seems like the one player that Iga sort of can't figure out. That virus that she acquired, whatever the virus is, some people think it's COVID, by the way, but it has affected her this whole time. She had to pull it. She played a grass court tournament earlier. I can't remember. Did she get beat or did she pull out of that too? I can't remember, but it was really quick. She was in and out, and it's kind of still affecting her to the point where defending her Wimbledon title is not a straightforward thing at this point, because we don't know what Drew's referring to is we don't know if she's even prepared to play at full strength here. If we knew that she was, this is a different sort of story here.
Yeah. And I think that's fair. She played two matches in Berlin. The first, she defeated the qualifier Polina Kudermetova, a different Kudermetova. There's a V and a P. The V is a good one. At least for now, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Maybe forever. But the then in round of 16, Donna Vekic got her. Donna lost the tiebreak, and then 6-3, 6-4. Neither of those performances did I think Rybakina, like, just she didn't have it. Right. It wasn't obvious to me that she was still dealing with it watching those. But after the fact, she's come out and been pretty vocal about how she's not feeling 100%. And, you know, there are a lot of videos of her practicing and stuff floating around where it's like she just doesn't look like anywhere close to the level of player you would have remembered from last year's Wimbledon. Yeah, I mean, and again, like the fact that she pulled out so suddenly from Roland Garros just tells you that you know, if she's not feeling it, she's going to go.
Yeah.
She's going to eject.
That ain't pulling out of this week. That's a real pullout.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, yeah, I think the Petra 3-1-ish for Q3 is worth a shot. Because, again, like, don't understand at all where Anz Jabeur's head is at. Like an early exit from her would not surprise me. It seems like, you know, the ghosts of grass years past is affecting her serve for whatever reason this year. So Kvitova could be looking at a soft quarter where she only really has to get through the likes of Ostapenko or Beatriz. Q3 could get a lot softer. Q4 is sort of the pretty clearly toughest for me.
Yep.
And I don't mind Alexandrova at 10-1. I make that a fair play. My Alexandrova number for Q4 is 7.45.
Okay.
So 10-1 is a decent play for her there.
I agree with every bit of that. Like, we are so aligned on that. That terrifies me because now we're just going to get destroyed. Yeah. And I would agree with you, even though I'm not betting Q4, I would even agree with you on the Alexandrova part. Like, that's the best value, but I'm not betting that, but that would be the best value of that group because Krejcikova is really a tease.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Andreeva, we have no idea. Keys, what's Keys number for Q4? I'm just curious.
8-1.
Oh, see that? I was hoping that would be already. Yeah.
There was somebody who is very, very sharp tennis better who was in the men, you know, we were DMing the other day and, he was like, this Keys price doesn't make sense. She always performs well at these slams. She's very lightly tested so far. Just in general, like, what is her fatigue from 2023 so far? It's pretty light. And you can look at that and say, well, that's because she's not going deep in these tournaments. She's not playing well. She's slipping. She's aging, whatever. But it doesn't change the fact that she's a lot fresher than some of these other women who did grind all through the clay, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, let's go to the men's side because I want to get this in. Now, this is not going to be as robust as the women's side because Djokovic and Alcaraz are at the top and they're the only ones in single digits to win the outright. But it is interesting to look at the quarters, and I'm going to guess Drew and I are not going to be quite as aligned on this. Maybe we will be. We'll see. Q1, Alcaraz it's not the easiest at all. I mean, he's got Zverev, he's got Dimonor, who's got really good grass numbers in there, TFO, Rune. That's in Q1. So they didn't really do Alcaraz any favors, in my opinion. Q2 is Medvedev and Tsitsipas's quarter, if you will. That features a whole bunch of players that have really good recent and non-recent grass form. The Mannarinos and the Greek Spores of the world. Even Cerundolo has been good on grass. Raonic, you never know if he got his serve going. He's basically a serve bot at that point, but we haven't really seen it quite yet. Tommy Paul is a really interesting player in that. Then you got your Scamnori, you got your Cordas, you got your Sheltons, you got your Cressys, and even Andy Murray in there. I mean, so it's loaded. So I don't have a bet there. I'm curious if you do. Q3 is where my bet would be. We'll see if we're aligned there. And then Q4, I'd love to say it's difficult because Rublev and Kyrgios and even a Bublik type are in there, but it's jokers. So can't really make a statement there. How did it lay out for you? Where did you see the bet?
So whereas the women's draw was clearly imbalanced, the men's draw is almost perfectly balanced.
Yeah.
There are two people who could win this and one is on the top and one is on the bottom.
if I said to you, I agree with you generally, but one quarter is slightly easier than the other three. What would that quarter be?
Q4.
Really? Okay.
Oh yeah. I think Joker got an absolute beauty here.
I would have said Q3.
Q3 is the weakest.
Yes, that's what I mean.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely is the weakest. Yeah. That is without question, surely. Q3 is extremely weak. I guess if you were to say winner comes from which quarter and you were to price it out, the winner coming from Q3 would probably be the long shot.
Yes.
And it would be substantially the long shot.
What is Sinner's price to win Q3 though? That's what I want to know.
It's like plus 250.
Okay, enough to play?
No,
No, not with
what I've seen from him this since the French Open, really. I mean, including the French Open, really.
It's interesting because there's an out of form Fritz. Like Fritz has the best numbers historically, but he's out of form. Mm-hmm. And then Casper Ruud's never gotten past the second round here.
He's been playing golf.
Yeah, he's been, and he's going to concerts all around the country. I don't know if you've seen his Instagram. He's all over the place.
The idea that he's in any way dialed in or intending to make any kind of noise here is pretty far-fetched in my mind. The middle class. So basically what you're saying and we agree in Q3, the top is question marks. The middle class is non-existent.
That's right.
And so that's why in general that quarter's so weak. I don't hate Fritz at 5-1. He's got some ghosts from last year too, though. People probably very, 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 vividly remember the loss to Nadal when Nadal had, his ab was split, and he still managed to find a way to beat Fritz in that match, and Fritz, lost his opportunity at a semifinal there, and then. But Kyrgios basically got the walkover to the final.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Nadal couldn't go. That's right.
Yeah.
This after, the Indian Wells, where it looked like Fritz wouldn't be able to go, and then he beat Nadal.
Yeah.
Nadal. Yeah.
And Fritz falls into an interesting category of players. Medvedev is in this category as well, where they played more clay this year than we're used to seeing, and they played better on clay this year than was expected. And then, for whatever reason, have completely no shown on grass.
Have you seen this? I don't know. I went to Indian Wells, but you don't have to go to a tournament to see this. But Medvedev does this thing where he takes serves from a mile behind the baseline.
Yeah,
that shit ain't working on grass.
No, that's a nonsense tactic on grass tennis. I honestly. He's a very, very smart guy, a very, very, very mentally sharp player. I have no idea why he is not talking to coaches or strategists to improve that, because that is a real, real obvious, easy to fix weakness. And he has so many of the same skill set as Djokovic that it doesn't make sense why he doesn't find that. Find some form on grass and threaten here. I thought maybe it was going to come this year after what we saw in clay, and it just has been the opposite. He's regressed from what I remember seeing from him in the past on grass. So
you got no bet in Q2, do you?
I don't mind taking a shot on a bigger number there. You mentioned Greek Spoor. He's interesting to me at 25-1, although he does fall in that category of, is he happy to be here after getting a title
That's right.
In the Netherlands, this grass run up,
what's Tommy Paul's number?
20-1. I was just going to mention Tommy Paul. Yeah. There are a couple of Q2 is going to be a big number, I think.
Yeah, I do too.
And there are a couple of Americans. That may end up being sort of the U.S. quarter, right?
Korda, Shelton.
Ben Paul. Shelton's in there. Paul. Maxime Cressy's in there.
Cressy's great.
Cressy has stunk out loud this year, but he is a grass player.
He's a grass guy.
It's in his bones. It's in his blood. It's everything about the way he plays on grass. He's built for this. Cressy could make a run here. Shelton could make a run here. Korda could. Eubanks could even. He's got a really soft little section up there going against Scamp potentially in round two. So there are a number of U.S. players that I think could make make it to deep into week two coming out of Q2.
I'm talking myself into a Tommy Paul, Drew.
20-1 is good.
Yeah.
He has a qualifier in round one who he should get through at worst 3-1. He gets potentially a qualifier or an out of form Milos Raonic. The ghost of Raonic still floating around in round two, and then round three, Francisco Cerundolo, who's been fine on grass. Tommy Paul could comfortably get to the fourth round of this tournament. And if Medvedev stumbles in round two to say Mannarino, then, or in round three to Griekspoor, then Tommy Paul could be looking at a quarterfinal here pretty comfortably.
I feel like I have to bring these two guys. So Tsitsipas, who now, by the way, dating Paula Badosa, for those who are curious about such things, you're not thinking about him in any way here, are you?
No. And if you didn't already know he was dating Paula Badosa, then you're doing a very good job of staying offline.
That's right.
Because
it's everywhere.
That's impossible to miss, even though I don't know who cares about that. But apparently a lot of people do enough to, you know, to have a lot of social media, noise about that.
The other person.
Yeah. He's completely out here.
The other person I have to bring up is Andy Murray, who has won this tournament, obviously part of the Big Four back in the day. You don't think, do you? No. Yeah.
There's only two men in this draw with, you know what? I'll give you something fun. Only two men in the draw have won Wimbledon, Joker and Andy Murray. Mm-hmm. Only one man in the draw has ever beaten Novak Djokovic on grass. Ooh. And it is Andy Murray.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. Andy Murray. You know, when he did it though, it was like 2015 or something. It was like good eight years ago.
Yeah.
Djokovic's numbers, I feel like we might have already covered this on your show on Wednesday, but his grass numbers are absolutely impossibly ridiculous.
Oh, it's ridiculous. He's a good, you can go ahead. I don't want to interrupt you, but I'm quantifying it right here. Just looking, he's a good, if I'm doing service points and return points, win percentages, and I'm combining them, like he's a good 6-7 points clear of the field historically.
Yes.
You know, yeah. So it's not, I mean, that's the thing. When we talk about guys like Djokovic or ego on clay, it's not hyperbolic, right? It's like the numbers just show you, how can this be? How can this one human being be this much better than all of these other professional players? It's incredible.
It really is. And career record for Djokovic on grass, 112 wins, 18 losses.
Really? 18?
That is, wow. That is rare air.
Yeah.
He has not lost on grass since. Do you want to guess?
No, you tell me. I don't want to guess.
Queen's final against Marin Cilic in June of 2018.
Marin Cilic, who won a U.S. Open. Yes.
It has been 5+ years since a man has beaten Djokovic on grass.
Wow.
He lost to Andy Murray at Wimbledon. It was actually 2013. So it has been 10 years since Andy Murray beat him. His other grass losses come at the hands of Juan Martín del Potro, Roger Federer, and Sam Querrey, all-time greats. Kind of focus on that one and get your opinion here. Sam Querrey beat Djokovic in one of the most ridiculous upsets I've ever seen on tennis in my life. It was in round 32 at Wimbledon. Querrey at the time had zero pedigree, was probably like 25-50 to 1 in that match. Djokovic's loss, I would describe, I remember in the moment thinking this, and nothing since then has changed my opinion, that he had a big old exhale after he won the French Open in 2016, because that was the last career. That was the last title he needed to close his career slam. And after he wins that 2016 French Open, he kind of exhales. He not dialed at all into, kind of preparing for Wimbledon. Didn't mean as much to him. And I think that's kind of how a guy like Querrey catches him early in the tournament. There is a hair of a parallel to this year for him, because he of course wins Roland Garros. This is his 23rd slam, which now puts him number one all time.
Top of the mountain.
So to the degree that he has any exhale and someone could catch him, by surprise in this tournament, just because he's not, dialed in the norm, to the normal, Terminator way, I think it's an open possibility.
I hear what you're dealing there.
Yeah.
The counter to the counter, right, would be, now that he's gotten off the vaccine banned slams, that he is so keen on grabbing slams, right? Mm-hmm. And he ain't getting any younger either. that will counter the potential lack of focus narrative that would counter that. And he'll be like, no, I want to tie Margaret Court here on Wimbledon, which is, you know, at Wimbledon, which is the one I'm supposed to win. Just like Iga was supposed to win the French, right? This is the one I'm supposed to win. Let me get to 24 and then let me get to the quarter century. And then let me just build a gap. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the more he wins, the less Carlos does for future, right? Because Carlos is going to get double digits at 1.2. So that will obviously, you know, he's already ruined. He, Federer and Djokovic and Nadal have already ruined a generation of guys getting slams. As John Isner famously said, they're just really greedy. You know, so that will go. I think it does beg the question, though. Let's get to the final, right? If we get to an Alcaraz Djokovic final. You said something interesting on a numbers game earlier, because you were a Djokovic guy at the French, as I recall.
Yeah.
Let's say they get to the finals here. Djokovic is going to be favored. You actually are going the other way, you think, on this one?
I mean, you know, price is going to determine a lot, right?
Yeah.
If Djokovic looks, you know, a little uninspiring, if his elbow is, you know, is concerning, if a guy that he has no business challenges him on the run up. And Alcaraz is in absolute dialed in FU mode. You know, the market may not give us a price to bet Alcaraz in the final. But my general sentiment is that starting at -150 or whatever he is to win, let me see what, wow, -173. Starting at -173 to win this title tells you that if it is an Alcaraz Djokovic final, which is again the most likely outcome by far. For this tournament, that's something like greater than 50% chance that that's what your final is going to be. The market is probably going to make it -400 Djokovic +325, +350 Alcaraz, which means betting Alcaraz now at +340 is insane. Because you can probably correct. Get that in the final.
Yes.
Right. And so you can avoid a potential loss where he just no shows in some round and somebody catches him on the way there and bet him at that time at that price, when in reality, there's potentially a narrower gap than people realize between Alcaraz and Djokovic on grass. There is a sentiment that Alcaraz just hasn't played enough grass. He doesn't have enough reps. And that's 100%. Fair. Like, I think he has fewer matches on grass than Djokovic has losses, even though Djokovic is the winningest player all time on grass.
That's brutal.
But you know, I definitely saw enough at Queens from Alcaraz to tell you that he's starting to figure things out. Like, his strategic approach to grass tennis was very impressive, I thought.
Are you worried at all? Obviously, for those who missed it, what happened at the French Open final was this, you know, most anticipated match ever, yeah. Certainly in recent history. And Alcaraz just kind of tensed up, like he just couldn't perform. Yips, yeah. One might even say. Do you believe that will not be the case if they eventually meet here, or do you worry that we will see some semblance of that again, and that this will actually, like, because if that happens again, we got a problem, right?
Oh, of course, yeah. And you know, if there's residual, you know, mental baggage from what happened, and he doesn't really strictly stand a chance, and -400 in that moment for Djokovic is right. My contention would be the pressure was on Alcaraz in that semifinal. He was a -200 favorite.
Yeah. Which is crazy. Crazy.
Yeah. It was crazy. In hindsight, it was ridiculous. I can't believe it. Even in foresight,
it was crazy. I thought. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a heaping amount of expectation on the young man who just doesn't have a ton of, not a ton of best of five experience. And for me, the way I handicap best of five clay is it is a long form chess match. You need to be, if you are relatively evenly matched with your opponent, you need to have some long-term strategy about how you ultimately get across the finish line. And Djokovic's, I thought, was pretty clearly on display what he intended to do in terms of drawing him out, in terms of making him play trying to make him play some impossible points, or, you know, to get his, breaks, particularly to get that second set. And yeah, the nerves, I think, contributed pretty substantially to the cramping that you saw. And that comes along with being the favorite in that moment and the expectation that you're going to win your second, you win that match, you win your second slam, you take the crown from Nadal that everybody is, kind of expecting you to do. And I think I see this as a very, very, very different, kind of macro pressure setup, right? He's playing with house money if he gets to the final against Djokovic. No one is realistically expecting him to win that match. And whereas Djokovic's, kind of strategic approach to the clay match, I don't think will work on grass, because the points are shorter. Just in general, the rate at which Alcaraz's serve is hitting and his winners versus unforced errors on grass so far from his run at Queens is wow stuff. I mean, it is really, really, really high level. Djokovic is going to have to solve that game in that moment. And I think that's going to be a tough challenge for him. We saw in the quarterfinal last year, Djokovic ran into an in-form Jannik Sinner, and it was a lot of the same problems. There was not enough tape. There's not enough signal of how do I beat this guy on grass, that he went into that match with this plan that was solid. He went in sort of, I'm going to figure it out on the fly. And it took him until the, 2.5 sets in before he was really kind of be able to play up to his level against Sinner in that match. And he had, it comes through, 3-2, largely, I think, because Sinner kind of folded it up mentally, which is a Sinner thing to do. And, Alcaraz, I don't think is built that way. And this is a long way of saying, if you get 3-1 on Alcaraz against Djokovic in the Wimbledon final, I will be backing the kid in that spot. And it's not going to be the, highest confidence play of the year for me by any stretch of the imagination.
It won't be your game of the year. In other words, yes.
No. Yeah. And will I be live trading that match and trading out of my Alcaraz position if he's up 2-0? Entirely possible. There is not a guarantee that I will ride that to the finish line. But I think almost certainly, he's got a puncher's chance, more so than I expect the market is going to give us based on what we see in the current outright pricing.
Okay. So on the men's side, do we have bets? Are you thinking of making a bet, or is there no bet?
Powder dry for that final, honestly.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, we'll see how this ages, but Alcaraz's path is tougher. His quarter is more challenging. I think you laid that out very fairly. A matchup against Demonauer in round four is going to be challenging. A matchup against, we didn't even tease like the potential for there to be a Carlos versus Rune quarterfinal.
Oh, like, yeah. I mean, I mentioned Rune, but I mean, there's
that would be cool.
Sasha Zverev, Demonauer.
I will hope for that.
Yeah, Tiafoe and Rune. And yeah, in that quarter,
tough quarter. He's going to have to beat at least two of those men to get out of there. An Alcaraz Rune match, that's popcorn fireworks stuff.
Yes, it is.
That would be freaking awesome for a quarterfinal, by far the best potential quarterfinal.
Yes.
There's not even anything else close. So hoping for that. Ultimately, if Alcaraz comes through that, I would expect he makes short work of whoever comes out of Q2. Hopefully it's, the likes of a Tommy Paul or
the old price
American flag.
Yep.
Gets to the semifinals there. And then, Alcaraz in the final against Djokovic would be my bet, in the blind, but we'll see.
I don't have these bets yet cause they're not available, but Tommy Paul in Q2 and Yannick, I don't know if I want to bet Sinner. Yeah.
What is your read on him?
I mean, again, if I were to do, again, we do, Kelly and I will do, sometimes we'll do our top rankings. He'll do golf. I'll do tennis. Jannik Sinner is the fifth best player in the world all court to me. He's been in every major quarter so far already in his career. Never advanced past that, but he has had really good results in slams, and he has given the benefit of a quarter here. I mean, what is it? Fritz Bautista Guten Ruud. Like, I mean, I'm looking at his quarter. I'm like, he ain't winning this thing, right? Mm-hmm. But his quarter, he might. I mean, I still trust Sinner more than I do the others. And again, historical grass numbers for Sinner, again, combining serve percentage wins and return percentage wins, It's like 105, which is, you know, not quite the elite of the elite, but it's top 10, you know, historically. So he's a solid grass player. He doesn't have numbers as high as Fritz does, though. You know, if Fritz was in form, I wouldn't be saying this.
Surely. Yeah.
But, you know, players that have higher numbers than him, Rune, Alcaraz, by the way, Berrettini, who we're not even worth talking about at this point, right? Sasha Zverev and obviously Djokovic. So, you know, really solid numbers, but not like elite, but he just got a really easy quarter. So I don't know. I'll see what the number is by the time I get to it. And maybe that's the play. I wouldn't talk about him if he was in any other quarter, though.
Yeah. I mean, his loss to Altmaier at Roland Garros was, that was painful.
Yeah.
That quarter was his to lose. And he managed to find a very, very uninspiring way to do it. His run up has not been especially impressive. Losing to Rusevori and Ertogenbosch was disappointing. And then retiring against Bublik in Halle is a concern, because he's a guy that has dealt with a lot of bizarro injuries. You know, stuff that you can't see when you're watching him play, but you hear about it and read about it. And, you know, they're like, man, why was he so off today? And you're like, oh, he actually, his entire hand is a blister.
Oh, wonderful.
It's like, oh, yeah. Like, oh, cool. Great, yeah, glad I knew that. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know that.
You mentioned Bublik in there too. Bublik's another guy. Like, if he wasn't in Djokovic's quarter, like, he'd be an interesting, you know, shot if he was in the right quarter. As a long shot, but
plus he's cursed.
There's that.
You know, he won Holloway, and you know, they lose in round one. I don't buy into that really at all. I don't think there is signal there. And Bublik is a really good grass player. I think he got a decent draw. If Mackenzie McDonald beats him round one, I mean, Mackenzie McDonald has some wild, weird Wimbledon wins on his resume.
Mackenzie McDonald, who this morning was just coasting to victory against who did he play? I already forgot.
Is it Eubanks?
Was he the Eubanks guy, or was that Lloyd Harris?
I got confused. Oh, no, that was Harris.
Oh, no,
Harris,
McDonald's playing Cerundolo.
Yeah.
He was 6-2, 4-1.
Yeah, he was beating him convincingly.
Yeah, he's done.
Yeah, and lost.
He's going to lose.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So there's that. Okay.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. We're doing this again early morning Friday, so I'd love to sit here and say, who do you like in the first round? But honestly, most of these matches are not out yet from where I'm sitting. You have Iga's -3,333 in her match against Lin Zhu. You got Kudermetova -1,000 against Kaya Kanepi in the first round. That's never pleasant, but that's what it ought to be. Kaya Kanepi, sort of a giant killer. Sinner's -2,500 against Juan Manuel Cerundolo. So, like you said, with the Kudermetovas, not that Cerundolo, the other one. And Djokovic, the old -10,000 against Sheen. But really, I haven't delved in these. By the way, Fritz versus Hanfmann is a pretty interesting first round match.
Yeah, tough one for him.
Yeah, even though he's a -455 favorite there. But they're not all out. At least I'm not seeing all of them out. Maybe I'm not looking at the right book.
No, I'm same here. It's weird. It's a weird smattering.
So not much to say on first rounders. But so bottom lining it, we're pretty aligned on the women's side. Certainly on the quarters, Swiatek, Kudermetova, 1 and 2. If we knew about Rybakina, we would fear her, but Kvitova's our girl in Q3, generally speaking, and I actually think she has a shot to win it all. Q4 is the question mark, but you do see the most value in Alexandrova. I would agree with that too. And then on the men's side, it's not as robust, but you expect the Alcaraz Djokovic final, and you probably, depending on the price, but if it's the price you're anticipating, will be a Carlos guy. And then you'll manipulate it if you need to.
And you're just riding Djokovic, right?
I'll be honest with you. I don't have that bet in pocket yet, but I think I will. Djokovic to win it all.
You got parlay, you said, right?
I have the parlay with Iga, and I have the parlay with Kvitova. So I don't think I'll take an outright on Djokovic. Got those in a faraway place at Bookmaker. So those were available there. I think Tommy Paul Q2, I think I've talked myself into that as my only other thing.
Do you have I like that one. I'm with you on that. If you can get 20-1 there, I think that's a fun play. There'll be an interesting somebody comes through Q2. My official predictions, I'll have Alcaraz over Rune in Q1. I'll take Tommy Paul over Maxime Cressy.
There you go.
In Q2. I'll take Man, it's tough to bet. It's tough to believe in Fritz, but I will take, you know, who we didn't mention who I think is going to make an interesting deep run is, Quentin Hallease. He's got the skill set to do some damage here, and he's got a nice spot on the draw. So he's going to make a deep run. He's a gigantic price. So that'll be a fun one. I'll take the super duper long shot, Quentin Hallease over, just an absolute, oh man, that section six is so weak. Holy smokes. Quentin Halley's over, geez, man, Rude's got such a soft section. I bet you he's bummed he didn't take this more seriously in the run.
He's like, oh my God, I could have won.
I could have won my quarter. Yeah. Man. Well, we'll take Hallease at the long price in Q3 over question mark. And then, I'll take Djokovic over Bublik in Q4. Djokovic in straights to the finals, where he loses 3-2 to Carlos Alcaraz.
Where he loses 3-2 in what would have to be a classic, one would assume.
Oh, yeah. That would be so good. That would be so good. I mean, we're not talking like all time, like Federer Djokovic in 2019, but it would be, that would be a big one.
What would you say? We'll close with this. What would you say are the greatest matches you've ever seen?
That Djokovic Federer final at Wimbledon is the number one with a bullet for me.
The Nadal Federer one where Federer loses and cries at the end.
I like that outcome. Yeah. That was a fun outcome.
I was gonna say, but could I interest you in Borg McEnroe in 81? Could I interest you in that?
The Djokovic Federer Wimbledon was that fifth set. The high leverage points were like every one of them was emotionally an emotional roller coaster. The Federer not taking the championship points he had was just like, how is this possible? The quality of the tennis was not very good for a lot of that match, but the fifth set was unbelievable. The quality of the tennis was the best, and the match was the best for the Australian Open final between Federer and Nadal, in say 2016, maybe.
It's interesting. For some reason, when I think of Federer, the image that pops in my head for his greatness was when he was first winning Australian Opens. So we're talking like 2000, don't hold me to the year, but like a decade before that, right? 2006-ish, somewhere in there, where he was doing things on a tennis court where you're like, I didn't know this was possible. Like the way that he could redirect a tennis ball and hit with, you know, go from defensive to offensive within a point the way that he did. I'm like, and that's when McEnroe, even at the time, he's like, these guys are better than we were. Like that, even he was like, that's it. I've seen it all. These guys are just incredible. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm getting chills just thinking about some of these, by the way, tennis hardo that we are.
No, it was 2017. Federer over Nadal went five sets at Australian Open. If you have never seen that, it was a wild one because Djokovic and Andy Murray were clearly the two best players in the world going into that tournament, but they had played so much and so long in 2016, deep into that season, and played each other so many times that they were both just totally broken physically. Meanwhile, Federer and Nadal had taken like a huge amount of time off to like fully recover. And Istomin beat Djokovic in that tournament. I think Misha Zverev beat Andy Murray, which opened the door for Federer and Nadal to get to that final. People were literally like, is Federer ever going to play, you know, at a high level again? He came in as a 17 seed.
For a little while longer. Yeah.
Yeah. He made that final, beat Stan Wawrinka in five sets in the semis, played Nadal in the finals. And this was one where you remember how important challenges used to be? They're not at all really anymore. Oh. Like for whatever reason, challenges are like not really part of the game. People are just kind of like, yeah, well, we believe in Hawkeye now, so we're just going to accept the result. Challenges used to be extremely important. And this is when, like, that fifth set was decided by like the narrowest margins on points I've ever seen. And like, literally it was like, was that in or out? I couldn't see it by eye. They challenge it. And it was literally like in by a millimeter, out by a millimeter. And that was like the margins that decided that match between those two. And it was, that was extremely memorable. So that was probably my favorite. Yeah.
To me, it's the most amazing thing in sports, like tennis at the highest level. You cannot compare to me mentally, physically. It's just incredible. And the and that's the thing. Like I've said this before. I don't know if I've said it on air, but like I remember I went to a high school that was considered a pretty big tennis powerhouse high school. And I remember that, you know, we had a guy that ended up playing number one singles at UVA, Virginia, number one singles at Navy. And I remember when the tour was in DC, you know, 3-4 years later when they were finishing college, I remember asking one, I was, oh, so you're going pro? And they just laughed at me, right? They're like, Gil, those guys are so much better than we are, right? Like it just, the levels that keep getting higher and higher, it's impossible. And then when you get to the gods, right? Like the notion that someone like Sasha Zverev, you know, has never won a Grand Slam and he can never get over the hump with the gods. They're so much better than he is. Imagine. So yeah, it's incredible. Last thing, because I just thought of one more thing. I lied. If someone's listening and saying, okay, how many bets typically does Drew have on the, in the first round daily at Wimbledon? Is there a pat answer to that? Or is it just how the numbers shake out?
No, I usually keep it. I usually try to cap it at like seven.
Okay, so he caps it at seven. That's right.
I mean, there's so many. There's so much. Many. There's so many. Like, you know, I don't have a strong reason for that other than like, I am a person in tennis that I want to put eyes on the matches that I bet because I want to know why. If I can even figure out why I was right or wrong, because that definitely influences future pricing. Like if you got lucky and won, you want to know why. You know, if you got unlucky and lost, you need to know. And so, you know, I it's tough to get that granularity of coverage because form and eye test matter to me a lot. And beyond just having a number that you think is fair when it comes to tennis, because it's a 1v1 sport. Yeah. And you know, if you can pick up like the nuances of a player form, injury, things like that, by watching it, then you kind of have to, I think, to really.
I'm glad that we brought this up because I'd never talked to you about that. I too, like in a first round of a slam, I will have up to six. But once I get to six, it's the same thing that you just talked about. I also start to feel like I should add more humility, right? Like I think to myself, if I think I have an edge in six matches, maybe I'm fooling myself kind of thing. Like, don't go any higher than that. Cause then you're lacking a humility in your numbers kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense. That's kind of how I process it. No, I'm like, okay, maybe I'm not that smart. You know what I mean?
It's funny too, to contrast it with like the NBA. Cause like we could go through a week in the end of January and I could have 25 bets in the NBA and I maybe didn't watch a game.
Interesting. Well, that's
and Jason. I assume I'm going to be able to get it out of my number. Like assume like if I was right or wrong, I can test it with the data that I've got to come up with my fares. It's not that easy to do that with tennis.
Jason Weingartner, we're just talking about that with baseball this morning, but for an entirely different reason. We're just like, he's like, I have a play on the Nationals versus the, you know, another fakakta team. And he's like, plus 159. And I always say, I go, you're not required to watch this baseball game. Cause like, who could sit through that, you know, kind of thing. Drew, appreciate it, man. We're less than 48 hours away. I thank you sincerely, man. Thank you for the time.
Oh, no worries.
As always.
Yeah, that was a ton of fun. And best of luck. And I'm sure we'll revisit the men's side before it's all said and done.
Yes.
But you know, the important thing is the women's tournament. You know, and you're coming up with fares, I think, on the front end, because it's going to be really good.
Going to be really good. We'll talk on the radio side this week. Drew Dinsick, everybody, at @whale_capper, Deep Dive at NBC Sports Bet the Edge podcast. Thank you, Drew. Appreciate it, man.
All right. Best of luck.
Best of luck to you as well on all your Wimbledon bets. Thank you so much for listening.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.